home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
And I'm Rob Watson, and I'm thrilled to be here. Happy holidays to everybody. It has been quite the holiday season with the passings of several iconic figures, George Michael, Carrie Fisher, and then her mom, Debbie Reynolds, and not to mention the imminent days before Donald Trump takes office, which has been intriguing and horrifying and disturbing and all sorts of other adjectives all at once. So, and many, many people wanting 2016 to quickly be over. And I'm probably one of them, although I am a little concerned about 2017. So, we've got to get our armor up, our hackles going. We have a huge equality movement to maintain and protect, and not a lot of resources to do it except our wits and our strength. And that's what we're going to do. But tonight, I have a really special show for you. We have the brain power, the creative forces behind a new documentary called The Guys Next Door. My main guest was supposed to be Amy Geller, who is the producer. Amy came down with something. Thank you, 2016, yet again. This week, but we are not at a loss because instead we have Ali Humanek, who is the director. She's an award-winning filmmaker and Emmy-nominated cinematographer. Her work includes Shadow of the House, Design Squad, and she is executive producer of Vita Health Communications. And we cannot wait to talk. The Universal Queen Victoria. I'm used to Garrett Miller being here. He is off tonight. But I am very excited to talk to Ali about this film because even though it isn't a direct parallel to my experience, there are quite a lot of similarities. So it is Killing Me Softly with its song. Ali, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for being here. So, wow. Tell us a little bit about the setup of the film with the couple that is Eric and Sandro and mm-hmm. Rachel and Tony and what their family situation is.
Sure. So Rachel was in her mid-40s and she went to college with Eric. And Rachel's married to Tony. She's three teenagers and she loves being a mother. She thinks it's really sort of rounded out who she is as a person, and she decides her friend Eric would make a great father. Eric is married to a guy, Sandro, and so she approaches them and she says, look, guys, I'd love to have a baby for you. And she does not use her, she's not offering to use her own eggs. She's offering to use her body, and they would buy eggs and use their sperm. So she does it, and then very quickly after doing it once, she does it again. So the film starts when Rachel is 8 months pregnant with the second child that she has for Eric and Sandro. And we start filming then, and then we follow them for about 3 years and look at what family can look like and, you know, what it can be.
Right. Yeah, no, it's the one thing. And I mentioned before I brought you on that, you know, it's so much of the film, you know, speaks to my life as a gay dad raising mm-hmm. two boys. Now, my sons weren't through surrogacy. They were through foster care adoption, but I had them as babies. Mm. And the trailer for the film starts out with Eric talking about children need motherhood and maternal energy, but it is not gender specific. And for me, that was such a profound statement and truth. Because that's been my experience that there is a maternal energy that happens. But for me, that all came through me with my sons. I gave them that maternal energy. And that's what I took from what I heard from the trailer. What of that did you see in the I'm going to call it a story, but through the life that you saw spilling out in front of the camera for you?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because that quote, which I think is very true in the film, is actually not in the film. And Eric is talking about the importance of maternal energy, but it not being gender specific. We actually don't even talk about maternal in the film, because I think it's a matter of it's a human loving energy, that it's a parental energy that has traditionally been associated with the woman, because the woman is often the one who traditionally has been a stay-at-home parent or is breastfeeding or is the primary caregiver in some ways. So for us, what was great in this film is that there are two men who are parenting, and Sandro does stay home, is more the primary caregiver at the beginning. But I mean, I think the film, you clearly see two men parenting their children, and in their parenting, I don't think anyone is saying, oh, they're missing maternal energy. They have, you know, women around them, but they don't necessarily need a mother to grow up happy, well-loved children. So
right.
That's
no,
like their family is complete with the two dads and the two girls. However, their family is also a more modern family in the sense that it also includes the surrogate and her husband and their kids, as they're more like aunts and uncles, and they're not, you know, they're two states away, but they get together every couple times a year. So there's
a
connection, but.
Yeah, that part because I haven't seen the film yet. I've just seen the trailer and read about it. I hadn't seen how close in proximity the surrogate family is to them. So they really are, there is no sense of, well, mom's actually coming in every once in a while. It's more, you know, literally an extended family.
It's much more like an extended family. And the title says The Guys Next Door, but it's more a play on who are your neighbors. And in some ways, these guys are just like everybody else. But on the other hand, they're not. They're also quite special.
Right.
And so, but in terms of parenting, they parent Rachel in the film. I think they get together. In reality, they get together several times a year. In the film, I think we only see them getting together twice or something like that. But so Rachel is not in and out as a maternal figure. She's not a mom. I think that the woman who's involved most is Eric's mother.
Right.
As the grandmother.
Right. Well, it's interesting because in my own life, you know, our family was very much the way you're describing. It was, you know, we were two dads. We had babies. We were raising the children. Every once in a while, there would be a woman in, you know, friend, relative or whatever there. Our sons never did what conventional wisdom or conventional cliches might have expected, where a woman walked in and suddenly they perked up and went, you know, oh, that's somebody who's missing, or, you know, it was just
right.
You know, some other, you know, satellite that kind of came in, but their focus was always on us as parents. Were you aware of any of the scientific studies, you know, when you were filming, or was this just put the camera on and watch the story?
I was aware of some studies about parenting, but that was not informing what we were shooting, because we were really wanting to see what unfolded. We didn't know where the film was going to go. And we started filming not so much because it was about surrogacy or even gay parenting. It was really about these are really interesting people, and we really liked them, and we liked their personalities, and we were curious about them as individuals and how they would come together as a family. So we just started filming, and we weren't doing research about, you know, gay parents or how do children who are brought up by same-sex couples, you know, turn out or anything like that. So it really was, there was nothing scientific about it. It was all just very human and watching life unfold.
Right, which is, is really part of its value, because it isn't there to support or deny anything. But mm-hmm. my experience, because there was a study out about gay men's brains, about as parents, and how, you know, when a straight man became a dad, you know, his brain morphed a certain way. And when a straight woman became a parent, her brain morphed a certain way. And they studied the brains of gay men who became gay dads and found that our brains morphed both ways at the same time.
Wow, and, I did not know that study.
Yeah. Well, the reason I find it fascinating and significant for me is because I don't know if you're familiar with Myers-Briggs portrayals and all that. Well, for years in business, I took Myers-Briggs over and over again. And my Myers-Briggs was consistent for literally decades. And I then stopped taking a survey to determine my Myers-Briggs profile until I became a dad. And it was like 6-7 years after that, I took it again. And for one of the markers in Myers-Briggs is a thinker feeler marker, where you are either a person who operates more as a thinker or more as a feeler. And I was always, every profile I took was almost one question that if I went one way or the other, I would be a thinker or a feeler. I was like that borderline. After I became a dad, I was way in the feelers field. Way. I mean, not even like close. It was like big, big old feeler.
Yeah.
And so it was fascinating to me, because it was the one marker that changed so significantly by simply by being a parent. And so I could see that brain morph evidence in that type of thing. So little,
I think that there's something, I do believe that there's chemicals that are released when we are parenting or caring, or, you know, having an exchange with a child or somebody that we love like that. I mean, I do think that experiences can actually rewire our brain. If the experience is repeated often enough, you actually develop new pathways. And one of the things I find interesting, and particularly about male fathers, is that there is a freedom to redefine your role as a parent in a way that I don't think heterosexual couples explore as much, because they so quickly fall into, or there are such stereotypical roles that men and women can fall into when they have children. But when you have two fathers having kids, it's like, oh, well, what are you going to do and what am I going to do? And there's more space for discussion and choices made than with, you know, a heterosexual couple who they may not think about all the choices that they actually have.
Right. No, you're nailing it. You're totally nailing it. That is exactly it. And that is exactly the experience, that the discussion on who does what tends to be more around who has the personal talents or bandwidth or different things in the family. And you are completely released from the gender expectations. You're both the same. So it's, you know, and there are certain jobs that are going to be done, or certain aspects of the parenting that are going to be done, and somebody is just going to do them. And I did notice there was a comment, and you can tell us whether it's actually made in the film or not, but there was a question, I think it was Eric was talking about how people asked them who was the woman. And he said, neither one of us wanted to be, quote unquote, the woman. You know, right. How did that play out in the film?
That is in the film, and it's in a section where Eric is saying, you know, it's surprising how traditional we've become. You know, parents, we've got two kids, we've got a house, and, you know, you put Sandro in a wig and heels, and we're the most conventional family there is. And then he says, but it's not that simple. You know, people always ask, you know, who's the woman in the relationship, and neither of us want to be it. And it leads into a discussion of his masculinity and his identifying as a gay man and his actual internalized homophobia that he has, that he sort of picked up growing up in a family and a society that was not very accepting of him as a gay man. And so it's like, neither of us want to be the woman. We want to be the man. But I want to be a man who can both be, not be afraid to have sides of me that could be called effeminate. And I don't want to be shy away from that, or I don't want to be putting myself down because of that. And it's not even what other people are saying. It's like, I grew up with the sense that perhaps I'm not male enough because I have some characteristics that may be called effeminate. So it's him struggling with his own identity as a gay man.
Right. Did you find it to start going into sort of a misogynistic territory? And the reason I ask that is one of the big sort of disconnects that I've found with other LGBT parents is around the parenting holidays, Mother's Day and Father's Day. Mm-hmm. I'm of the philosophy that children are nurtured and mothered and parented or fathered. And so families experience, we treat those holidays as celebrating parental aspects. And I've also found, though, that a lot of people are very gender-driven in their perspectives on those holidays, that, no, Mother's Day is for the woman, physical woman parent, and Father's Day is for the physical male parent. And that's how it, quote-unquote, should be. And my ex-partner, we actually got into kind of a heated thing because, and it was very similar to the themes that you were just describing in the film, because he was just deathly afraid of being perceived as, quote unquote, a woman, you know, and he did not want to be celebrated on a day that he saw as Woman Day.
That's interesting. I do not know how Eric and Sandro handle Mother's Day and Father's Day. I know that, that Eric doesn't like the term, earlier he didn't like the term maternal energy because he really thinks it's a parental thing. But how that breaks down into sort of these American holidays that are gendered, that's a really good question. And I'm actually going to see them on New Year's, and I can, I'll ask them how they handle it. But, you know, something that I do find interesting, and it's probably different having boys, but Eric and Sandra have two girls, and they, when they play house, one daughter is the mother and one daughter is the father. And it was very interesting to watch them play house. And even though they have two fathers and they have no problems having two fathers, still something that's come in from the culture that when they play house, there's a mother and a father.
Right.
And I don't know if your kids ever played house or family or anything.
They played games, and you know, they were raised with a lot of other kids that were through similar, you know, foster care. So there's a whole group of friends that they have literally grown up their whole lives with, include girls and boys. And when they were very young, they were all very gender neutral in that kind of way. But as they've gone through school, there definitely have been influences that have made them get boxed. And in fact, I wrote an article about it because I got challenged on it by an editor I worked with who was in the UK, and they had a program over there about toys without gender. And I walked into a toy store in the United States, and I hadn't looked up to see the signage, but the signage was very clear. I mean, it was like action, sports, we're all blue boys, you know, empowerment words, all that sort of things. And I looked up and the pink was fashion and cooking. And that was it. And the aisles that were girl aisles were all pink, you know, and it was like, it just, you know, it really shocked me to notice what was going on. And, you know, the kids know that. I mean, my boys,
they do.
An arbitrary girl color, but at a certain age, my boys completely rejected it because it was a girl thing, you know, and that was never anything that they were raised with.
Which is so interesting because girls more easily can reject pink and take on blue. Like, girls are a little more fluid in some ways. Like, they can be,
right.
they can like pink or they can like blue, and they don't get sort of put down if they like blue, and where guys might not want to take on pink. And I think that that's a problem. One thing that I have trouble with the gender thing is, like, when you're in school and the teacher will say, okay, all the boys to the left and all the girls to the right. And I'm thinking, why are you making these kids gendered? You know,
right.
they're five, they're three. How about say everybody whose name begins with an A, go here, or everybody that's got, you know, green on, go over here, and everybody that's got white on, go here. And if the numbers aren't right, then you mix it up. But why are we, you know, labeling blue as boys and pink as girls, and then even telling them to line up as boys and girls? I think that that's a real problem, and it's also a missed opportunity. Here's a chance to teach them about colors and letters, and not just say, are you a boy or a girl?
Absolutely. No, and you're absolutely right. It's you know, the thing that is underscored every day in just what you're describing is this perception and putting the seed out there that there must be something different because of their gender. And that's not even touching on the kids that are in those lines that are actually in their hearts transgender.
Yes.
That
yes.
you know, are where that statement is actually creating a subtle issue for them, even then. Allie, let's go back though. How did you guys come across this family and fall into this project to begin with?
Amy came to me. Amy went to Bates College and she had a college magazine and she read a story about Rachel, because Rachel had also gone to Bates, which is a college in Maine. And it was a story about Rachel having had a child for Eric and Sandro. And then at the end of the article, there's this tiny little print that says that she's doing it again. And Amy got very excited about the idea. She called Rachel, they met, and Amy said, I don't know what this will be, but I'd be interested in making a film. Are you open to it? And Rachel said she was open to it, but she would check with the guys. And then Amy came to me and she said, hey, yeah, she told me about it. And she said, do you want to make this film with me? Because Amy had never directed before. She's an amazing producer and has made a bunch of films, but she's never directed. And she came to me and she said, would you co-direct this and shoot it? And my initial response was, sounds interesting, but no, because I thought she was wanting to make a film about surrogacy and or even gay parenting. I mean, I thought she was
right.
thinking making a subject or topic-driven film. And documentaries, independent documentaries, are so hard to make. They take a lot of time and energy. And if I'm going to make a film, I really like them to be character-driven, because I want to be spending time with people that I like or who I find very interesting for whatever reason it is, whether we share the same politics or not. And so I said, you know, Amy, I'm not so sure, but I'd be happy to go and meet everybody and do some shooting so that you can gather some footage so you can begin to apply for grants. And so one weekend, Eric and Sandro, who lived in New York at that point, Rachel and her husband Tony and their three kids were all going to New York to be together with Eric and Sandro. And so Amy and I went to New York and we met everybody. And from the beginning, I started filming. You know, we literally met them when the camera was rolling. And after the, you know, first several hours of filming, you know, I think Amy and I looked at each other and we were thinking, yeah, there's something here. And I said to Amy at the end of the day, I said, look, if you're interested in taking a journey with this family and sort of jumping off a cliff and seeing, as filmmakers jumping off a cliff and seeing where this journey goes, because we have no idea if what's going to happen or if it's going to be interesting or if it's going to read well in film, then I'm ready to take that leap, because there's something that's very interesting about these people. Something's grabbing me and I really loved their energy. And so Amy said, great, let's do it. And in retrospect, when Amy and I have talked about it, I don't think she was talking about making a film, and neither does she, about surrogacy. She just, there was a story there. She couldn't put her finger on it and she wanted to explore it. And so, you know, we really, turns out we were coming from the same place of there's
yeah,
a story.
Fantastic.
We don't know what it is. But.
Yeah. And that I'm totally on board with you on that. It's even when I write, it's with that same perspective. It, there's a backdrop there and it does
yeah.
make the point, but you can't go in making the point. You have to show real life and let people discover the points on their own. So give us a little portrait of who, you know, and I know these are real people, but, you know, for the perception of the film, you know, who are the characters and what did you find out about each one of them that fascinated you?
That's interesting. Because the film is very much crafted around sort of the three main characters, which are Rachel, Eric, and Sandro. It's sort of like the film doesn't have a particular event that it builds to. It's not a traditional three-act film where you build to a particular event and then you sort of unwind. It's more like going on a journey, like I said before, and getting to know people. It's sort of like an onion being sort of unraveled. And so you meet Rachel. You see that she's the mother of three children, and you see that she offers to have this baby for her friends. And you don't really know why. It's like, what would motivate a woman in her mid-40s to do this for her friends? So you sort of enter with that question. And what we learn about Rachel is that being a parent has really profoundly changed her. That as a child, she often felt like an outsider. She grew up in a Jewish family, but in a neighborhood where there weren't many Jewish families. And so she really sort of felt like an outsider. And it was having children and being with her family and her kids and her husband where she really felt grounded. And so that was an experience for her that made her feel whole. And so that is who Rachel is in this film. It's somebody who gives in part because having a family made her feel whole, and she thought that Eric would be, in particular, Eric would be a great father because she knew Eric better than she knew Sandro, but she thought that they would make great, great parents. With Eric and Sandro, we learned that both of them grew up with homophobic mothers. Sandro grew up in a much more homophobic society. He grew up in Sardinia in Italy, which is a small island. And Sandro is somebody who always wanted to have kids, although he didn't think it was possible because he was a gay man. And he's somebody that grew up in a community where he did not tell his family that he was gay until he was married to Eric and he had a daughter on the way. So he's somebody that having a family for him allowed him to really open up, and in living in the United States allowed him to live authentically as a gay man, where he wasn't even open with his family in Italy. And he wouldn't have been able to live authentically as a gay man in Italy because surrogacy is illegal.
Right.
So
right.
Sandro's trajectory is sort of, we see him first as this great father, and then we roll back and we're like, wow, this is what he came from. He didn't tell his family that he was gay. He never got to tell his mother because she died sort of, you know, 2 weeks after he met Eric. So that was something that was very painful for him. And one of the things that happens to Sandro, sort of his sort of, I'd say real moment of realization, is that he starts to cry when he's in Italy. We go to Italy with him one summer, and he starts to cry because he sees a picture of his mother, and she's dressed in black. And it was shortly after his father died. Sandro was young. He was three or four when his father died.
Right.
And he's crying. And you know, we say, what's so sad? And he goes, it's just, I'm seeing the pain in my mother's face like I haven't seen before. And now that I'm a parent, I'm not saying exactly what he says, because he's a little more poetic. I'm sort of getting at the meaning of what he's saying. But essentially, he's saying, I'm relating to my mother's pain in a way that I couldn't relate to before I had my girls. So, or before I had my children. You know, now I understand that she was hiding her pain from me. And he now understands what it is to be a parent and what it is to love a child so much and what it is to want to protect your child and not
right.
have them see your pain. And it was just, he was so sad that he couldn't tell his mother that he show his mother who he was and love her, you know? So there, it was sort of bittersweet for him. And then in the end of the film, he realizes, or he believes, you know, if my mother were here today, I think she'd be proud of me. You know, she would love to be here for me and for these girls. And
right.
Eric is very different from Sandra. I mean, Sandra sort of falls in love immediately, and Eric is more of a slow burn, and it takes him time. And we see that, we've already talked about Eric a little bit, is that he has sort of an internalized homophobia that he carries around with him, and he's very concerned that he doesn't pass that on to his kids, that sort of anxiety, that this generalized anxiety that he carries
right.
around. He doesn't want to pass on to his kids. And he's aware, he's the one that brings up this sort of nature nurture question, which is, you know, how he's holding his daughter at one point and he kisses her and he says, oh, you know, you look so stressed. Are you, you know, like your father, you've got the weight of the world on your shoulders. And he says, is this a indication of what your temperament or how you're going to be in the future.
Right.
So there's these
right.
these moments throughout the film where he'll bring up something and towards the end of the film, he's commenting on, you know, the idea that we don't really know if it's nature or nurture or, you know, how much we're born with or how much of it is the way we're brought up that defines who we are. And the film's not trying to answer anything. It's just putting it out there that as a very young child, you start to manifest things that might just be how you were born, your DNA, or is it your environment? And I think that that's speaking to this question that we were talking about earlier, which is, does it really matter if it's two men or two women or a man and a woman? What matters is that you're loving your kids. And there's
right.
certain things that you're not going to be able to change because that's just what's baked into their DNA. And then there's
yeah,
other
things
that
you can
change.
I have to tell you, I saw an aspect in the film that I related to very strongly, and it's going to surprise you as to what what was happening in that scene that I really, really, really related to. And it was the scene where Rachel sees her. She's talking about how she forgets she's pregnant, and then she sees her son in her and notice she's pregnant. And she kind of theorizes that it's because she's actually carrying the baby for somebody else. And I related to that so much because as a foster parent, you are put in this weird position where you are handed kids that could become your forever children,
right.
or they could be going back to their birth parents who are in reunification services for them. And so you're asked as a parent or potential parent to be in this weird emotional mental state where you could be either one of those things. You know, you could either be this babysitter for somebody else's kid or this is your child. And we had many placements before we got my two sons that became permanent. And with those placements, we had a problem. Didn't connect, you know, we connected as caretakers and caring for the child and nature and everything else. But when the children were ours, we almost got a spiritual sense of it before intellectually we knew for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All of that emotional attachments kicked in. And so when she got what she meant by that, it was universal experience.
I'm sorry, we are breaking up a little bit. I'm Uh-oh. Hearing what you're saying. I got the sort of gist of what you're saying, and you're right. I am surprised when you said what you related to, because my mind was like, oh, what's he going to say? And I'm fascinated that that's what you responded to. And I just think how wonderful that you were willing to again and again take that emotional journey. I mean, because how difficult to not know if these children that you have are going to stay with you.
Right.
And if I understood what you're saying, it's that you were sort of in limbo, and it wasn't until you knew that they were going to stay with you that you could actually really open up your heart Is this what you were saying? That then you could really sort of open up your heart and let these beings into your life, and that you were somewhat reserved before? That's where we broke up. So I wasn't exactly sure
actually,
what you were saying.
That's where I broke up. Well, actually, no, what I was saying was that when, in my particular case, when we got two boys that were going to be ours, mm-hmm. we sensed that they were going to be permanent from whatever
I see.
Emotional that this was going to be it, and we kind of went there anyway. You know, I mean, we could have had our heart broken, and there were several times when it was very scary that we were going to have our heart broken, but we went there. I mean, we that was the emotional, you know, characteristic that we put our bit first. We were comfortable taking care of these kids and letting them first and rooting their parents. You know, it was just this that had no biological reason. It was all, you know, spiritual emotion. And so that was the connection I saw with Rachel, where, you know, it's like when you're in a different position, even though she has this child in her body, that it's just different.
Right. Right.
So, Ali, tell us a little bit about the film process. Happening with it and where to go?
The film, the process, I think you asked what the process was and where is it going. The film, Amy and I started filming in just November of 2011. And the film premiered in Sarasota in 2016. So we filmed intensively for about a year. And then after that we were editing, and then we would sort of go back and film every couple months we would film. But for the first year we were filming, almost once a month or more. And when we filmed with the guys, we would go and live with them because they live in Maine and we live in Massachusetts, and they're about 2 hours from us. And we would go and we would stay in their house, which enabled us to have, a real intimacy. Partly because we were staying with them, but partly because of the way that we approach filmmaking. And that is, I shoot and often take sound alone, and I don't use lights because in situations like this, because I feel like the apparatus I have of filmmaking can get in the way of real life. So if I can just be there with a camera, and when Amy was there, she was taking sound. And if it's just us and we're not introducing lots of other things, then it can be more intimate. And I think that in the film, it often feels as if the characters have forgotten that we're filming them. And whether they've actually forgotten or not, I'm not sure. At times they said, yeah, you were just there, and we actually weren't aware that you were there. That allowed us to get some really intimate moments. And so I think we built the film we looked at the footage, and we found our most intimate moments, our most revealing moments, and we started building the story. And in terms of where the film has gone, it premiered in Sarasota in the spring of 2016. And then it's traveled to a bunch of film festivals. We've been very excited that we've won some best of, we've won audiences awards. And most recently we won a best documentary award in Alabama, which was really cool to be in a southern state. And at that festival, we've developed a relationship with some Planned Parenthoods, because they have, now I'm forgetting the word, but they have partners in lots of different states. And we've connected with Planned Parenthood in Mobile, Alabama. And they loved the film, and they decided that they wanted to have a post inaugural celebration of family. And so on the day after the inauguration, they are going to be screening our film in Mobile, Alabama. And they have brought together, I think, a chapter of equality, pride, free to be. And they have brought together seven other organizations that are going to host a screening for their town. And they're paying for it. And they're just saying, come watch this film, come celebrate it as a family. And then what we're doing is for people that are at the screening, we're going to give them a code so that they can download or, you know, rent the film online cheaply. And the hope is that if they like the film, they'll then go share it with someone else who might enjoy the film or someone with whom they might have an interesting conversation.
Right.
So
right.
we're delighted that, that Planned Parenthood has sort of picked it up and is running with it. And especially the day after the inauguration, it's a nice celebration.
Do you guys have plans for West Coast premieres?
We don't have one yet. So we just got into a festival. Oh, I'm not allowed to talk about it. We did just get into a festival out in the West, but not on the West Coast yet. So we are working on that.
Yeah, we need you in that, because then I want to get you on my other show out in Santa Cruz, which is in Northern California AM and FM market. And we'll get you well known out here too.
Well, that would be great. We'd love to. We need to get out there. So it's a slow process. Getting the film out.
And the commitment of you guys, I mean, 3 years filming and then, you know, the process of getting out there. I mean, you really are having your own. This is not minor.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up, but I'm thinking
it's like having a child of your own.
Oh, right. Yes. You know, I had a bad joke at one point that, you know, well, not a bad joke, but I personally do not have children. And making films they have been my children. It's sort of like caretaking and then letting these films go out into the world and letting go of them and letting them have a life of their own. It's like you put in as much as you can put in, and then children will be who they are and people will read what they will into the film, and I no longer have any control over it. So they are sort of like my babies. And like parenting, Amy and I aren't being paid to do this. We've had to do a lot of fundraising, and all the money has gone into paying our editors or, you know, paying the people who do the sound mixing and the color correction and all that kind of stuff. And it has been a real labor of love for us to get this, to make this film and then to get it into the world. I mean, we both work as filmmakers. I work as a cinematographer and she works as a producer, and, you know, this is our personal project. And we've been delighted to see how well it's been received. So it's done well at film festivals, and now we're working to get sort of wider distribution and to get it seen on television, or, you know, get it onto Netflix or Amazon and have it used educationally and just seen as widely as possible. And so actually one way people can see the film right now before we actually have a big launch is we are selling it. If people go to our website, theguysnextdoorthemovie.com, or even if they just Google The Guys Next Door, the movie, they'll come to our webpage, and there they can either watch the film on Vimeo or they can order a DVD. So if people are interested in seeing the film, they can first go and see the trailer and then decide if they want to see it.
Perfect. And I'll be putting up the URL to those on our Facebook pages and Twitter accounts too. So we will put them out there for people to find. What was the biggest surprise for you, Tori? You saw it unfold. What part of the story surprised you? Didn't expect was going to be there.
That's hard to say. I think one of the things that surprised me wasn't so much the story, but it was how open this family was to us filming and how much they brought us into their family and the bond that developed between all of us. You know, it was a real privilege to become part of their family and to go through some of these experiences with them. So I don't know that that's a surprise. I mean, when I've made films before, you do develop close bonds, but it was really lovely the way this one unfolded. I'm not sure what the surprise was. It was more just sort of an enjoyment of getting to know people and getting to know people in a way. I mean, one of the things about filmmaking is that you get to know people in sort of a condensed period of time. And so you will sit down and we'll talk to people and you'll ask questions that you might not ask your friends because you're not interviewing them and you're not making a film about them. And so because we're interviewing these guys, we're making a film about them. We ask them very particular questions about when did you do this and why did you do that and what were you thinking? And even though that's not in the film, it's us getting to know these people. And it's really great. You have this sort of liberty in a way to just ask questions.
Right.
And I'm in general a curious person, but you don't always have the license to ask all the questions that you do sometimes when you've had people agree to let you make a film about them. And so we got to know.
Being a radio host, I have to be able to go into radio host mode when I go to a place to like that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. You broke up.
It's like being a radio host. When you go to a party, people don't like when you go into radio host mode and start interviewing them.
Right. And it's hard, though, because if that's you're curious, so you do want to ask some of those things. But, you know, in some ways it's probably easier to be a radio host or a documentary filmmaker asking questions at a party with people you don't know super well than with people that you know. I wish I had asked some friends questions or, you know, family members questions that I was able to ask these guys right off the bat.
I wanted to ask you about some of the you talked about Rachel and that. What about Tony, Rachel's husband, and some of the other people outlined? What was their reactions to what were going on?
Tony was great because Tony's memory of the whole thing was that Rachel didn't so much ask him what he thought about her having babies for Eric and Sandro. It's more like he was informed, you know, I am going to be having a baby for these guys. And he's funny about it because he's like, I wasn't really consulted, but how could I say no? You know, it just reminds me that Rachel is a woman who really leads from her heart. And I didn't mind, but it was complicated because he grew up Catholic with a very conservative family. And one of his first thoughts was, you know, how am I going to tell my parents? And how am I going to tell my parents? Not only did we do it twice. I mean, did we do it once, but we're doing it a second time. And so Tony sort of jokingly says, well, you know, I told Rachel she can have as many kids as she wants, as long as she gives them away. Not our kids, but any additional kids she's got to give away. So he is, he's supportive, but he also brings up a sort of counterpoint, which is not everybody is as accepting of this as he is, and even his family may not be very accepting of what they're doing. And then there's Elle, who is Eric's mother, and she talks, you know, partway through the film, she says that, you know, she grew up in a very homophobic environment, and one of her biggest fears would be that her son would be gay. And she had a sense very early on that Eric was gay, and she was just terrified. She's like, I just don't want that to be his story. And so she discouraged, you know, he came down once and he was dressed in all of her scarves. And he's sort of like, how do I look? And she's like, you look terrible. And because that was a point in which, you know, it wasn't accepted and women were blamed. If she felt she'd be blamed if her son was gay. And so she shares that story. And then we don't know how she transformed, but clearly she's transformed because she loves her son. She loves Sandro. She loves her grandchildren. And I think that, you know, the film is suggesting, or I think it says that, you know, children are your children and you love them. And she accepted that he was gay. And I think that the film couldn't go into what she went through to accept that. But I think the biggest thing in accepting that he was gay was him accepting it. And so when he came out to her, when he came out to his family, she said it was just like shackles had been released, because now he could be authentically who he was, and she could be more authentically who she wanted to be as his mother. And that was a really profound thing that she says. And so she sort of is in there and represents those people who are like, well, aren't comfortable with something until they know somebody. Like something seems odd, like, right. Oh, two dads or two moms. And then you meet two dads and two moms and you realize, oh, that's not so odd or that's not so strange.
Go into their own clothes. You know, what do they tell people now? They have this gay family member. When can people hold it open? You can't really hide it. Was she willingly exposing herself, or did that force her hand a little bit?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question because you were breaking up.
Sorry, did because her son was having children with his husband, did that force her?
I'm piecing together what I think you're saying, and which is you're asking if when Eric had children with Sandra, did that force her hand? And if that's what you said, no, it didn't. I think once Eric came out to her, he was in college when he came out to her. And I think that I'd have to check with her, but I don't think her hand was forced. I think once he was out, that she was more comfortable with it. I think that her concern actually was that he was safe and that, you know, that he was protected. And I think she was still a little concerned about how the world would treat him. So I think she had that concern, but I don't think she had a concern being open about having a gay son.
Right. You mentioned that Rachel were involved.
I couldn't hear. I'm going to repeat what I think you're asking me, is that Rachel was the surrogate. Her eggs were not involved. The guys bought eggs and then fertilized them, and then they were transferred into Rachel. So there's no, they're not her eggs, but I, you know, there's been all kinds of studies about what happens when the baby's, you know, in utero. And my guess is that Rachel had an influence on the kids. I mean, she loved being pregnant. She was in a loving family. The kids loved that their mom was pregnant, and so the girls got a head start in terms of coming from a loving family. I mean, Rachel also has the ability to be so giving because her family does have some money, so she could afford to not be working the whole time, and so it's not something that a lot of people can do. But I also think that's one of the things that Rachel wants to do, having grown up with some money, she really wants to be able to give back to the world. And one of the ways she does it is by having babies for Eric and Sandro.
Right.
At one point though, she did consider using her own eggs. I think initially she was going to use her own eggs, and then it got complicated because then she thought about, well, what does that mean to my kids that they have a half brother or a half sister there? And you know, what would it mean for her to have part of someone else raising a child who's genetically related to her? So I think pretty quickly she decided that she was not going to use her own eggs.
Right. That was what we hit, and that's exactly what happened. Was the what is emotional involvement with somebody that was a surrogate going forward?
Yeah. What other questions? I'm not sure, but I think one of the things that we've found in this as we screen the film at various places. I think the thing that we've been most, I wouldn't say surprised, we love the way the film has really become an advocacy film in a way, but it's not, it doesn't hit you over the head. There's nothing overtly political about it. We never come out and say anything about this is how family should be. There's, it's not sort of a polemic, but it's amazing the conversations that it has started and to see how people are looking at it and saying, here's an example. My father saw the film. My father is not, my father's conservative. He's not particularly comfortable with homosexuality. And after he saw the film, well, first of all, when I said I was making the film, I was like, why are you making that film? And then he wanted me to go into all the legal issues that there might be with having children and somebody being a surrogate. And then when he saw the film, after the film, he went up to Sandro and he said, you know, there's a scene when you're having dinner with Eric and I saw my wife in your face. And it's a scene in which Eric is talking about how much he's going to be traveling. And Sandro sort of has his head in his hands and he's, and you could just see that he's overwhelmed and that Eric's going to be gone a lot. And the fact that my father could see himself in, or his wife in Sandro, was sort of amazing to me that he was able to make that leap, that he was able to insert himself into this gay couple and take something very personal. Yeah. And the way that you said that you related to Rachel being a caretaker for somebody else's children. So the way the film can speak to people in unexpected ways has been wonderful for me.
Amazing. Amazing. I want to thank you. We're out of time. This has been great. I can't wait to have you guys on out in Santa Cruz. We've got a much more stable technology platform, I might mention.
We'll do it in person there.
So you know, I want everybody to check the film and buy it. And you know, it, we can't wait to see it out there in the film circuit. And it's fantastic. So thank you so much for joining me tonight, Allie.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Okay. All right. And you've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Tune in next week and we'll have another exciting guest and listen to Garrett Miller's Rated G Radio. And check out Garrett.com for his CD, Lawn Jesus. And until next time, this is Rob Watson. We'll talk to you later.